Action Park Media.
What would you describe as the low point, Ryan?
Probably the fact that when the 4 years was up, I was willing to walk away from it.
At 27 years old, his football career over in less than 4 years, Ryan Leaf found comfort in the form of a prescription painkiller, Vicodin.
Oh, he wanted to coach. There was an opening, and I called the coach. I said, boy, that's a no-brainer. That guy's really good, and you really like him.
Price's call was to West Texas A&M University. The Buffaloes needed a quarterback coach for the 2006 season, and Ryan Leaf needed a job.
I'd love to coach you, and I'm gonna be around for a while because I like it here, and everybody treats me great.
You know, I wanted to give him a second chance. First chance in coaching, but a second chance in life. And 100% of the time, you know, people have been impressed with who he is and what he stands for today.
Where are you headed?
Where am I headed?
Just in life, this is a broad question, but just life in general. Where are you?
Up.
Through the fall of 2008, Leaf fed his habit, complaining of old football injuries to local doctors and frequently ordering pills online until his money ran out.
You're now listening to Bust, the Ryan Leaf story.
So I wake up the next morning after being found out by my boss, the athletic director, and then already with the humiliation of that, having to resign from my job as a coach, the anonymous email that the mother had sent to ESPN hit the wire. And when I fuck up, it's not some behind the scenes, you deal with it in exclusivity. It is a national story. I'm a national fuck up. When that happened, my family found out because it's been a story of my life. I had a relationship with my family through the media because I would never tell them the truth about anything. So when they heard a lot of the stuff, it was through the media. And sure enough, when it hit the wire on ESPN, there's a story first, and then it just runs on the ticker underneath. There really wasn't any context to it all, other than I had resigned from my job around some sort of drug crime. So that just allowed for any sort of hyperbole to happen. Now he's just a worthless piece of shit, on top of being a failed football player, right? All these identities of who I was now the public to dissect once again, and I did not know what to do. I'd slept on it the night before, knowing I'd lost my job, but it was at little old West Texas A&M. No one was really gonna hear about it. That's just never the case. When I say national fuck-up, I'm a national fuck-up. It's a national story. I don't have any pills because I had stolen from the player that got me in trouble, and I'd taken those. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't go to a doctor. Now it was like, everybody's gonna know about it, so now I'm outed completely. I drive and get like a fifth of vodka. I go to a dark place, which is a movie theater. I sit up in the balcony part of it, and I just start looking at my phone and the messages that are coming in. And I'm just pounding this booze so I don't feel any of it. And then I start to see some from my family, my dad, and my initial texts back to him were filled with suicidal tendencies. They were, why am I here? Why am I living? I don't see a point. And so when your father sees that, fear immediately overcomes in that situation, and he reaches out to the girl I was dating at the time, Rachel. She can't find me. They call the police. I'm the only one in this theater in Amarillo, Texas, in the middle of the day. The movie was Changeling with Angelina Jolie, just this really kind of dark movie as it was. And I'm just incredibly depressed and medicating with the booze until all of a sudden a couple officers walk up into the top deck of the movie theater and check and see if I'm okay. They walk me out. Rachel had known that's where I'd like to go, is to the movie theater by myself, and she guessed right. One of the coaches I coached with, Colby Carthel, showed up and started talking about what was transpiring. The police, of course, were wonderful. You know, they didn't let me get in my car and drive. They dropped me off. It was kind of a wellness check situation. And I talked to my coach, and I can't remember who else was there, but I think there was some crisis management around, you know, what I had done, how that's going to affect with the family that I'd stolen the pills from. It's a blur, but all I can tell you is that it was utter chaos. The world in my eyes had imploded. There was no answer. There was no way out. We get back to the house. My brother and my father had made flight arrangements. They were flying down. This is when the first mention of rehab was being tossed around. Like, really, where I didn't just dismiss it. And so while they were flying down and the world was just crumbling around me, I started going online and looking at treatment facilities, what that meant. And of course, I have to control everything. So I was looking for, you know, the most therapeutic optically, environmentally maybe too, because some of the main ones that were tossed about were the Betty Ford Center in Hazleton in Minnesota, which is more of a medical facility. Menninger down in Houston, which is a more of a medical facility. And so I ultimately found a place in Vancouver. Now, I thought it was Vancouver, Washington. Turns out it was Vancouver, Canada. And this will play into the story later because I would go outside my own country to get the help that I needed. My dad and brother showed up, kind of a come to Jesus conversation, really supportive. You know, I talked about the friends that, the entourage that I kept around me at all times that never told me no, always said it wasn't my fault, saw me as the golden goose. It's ironic that the people that kind of cut me out of their lives and I cut out of my lives because they were the actual ones showing me the mirror on how I was behaving, my brothers, my family, were the ones there in the worst possible time. And those others that were always around in what people considered the good times or where I just, you know, chiseled my life away to the bone were nowhere to be found. It's not a surprising story because we hear that all the time, but they were there to support me and want to see me get better. And so I said goodbye to Rachel and headed to treatment. I bring up Rachel's name simply because it's a pattern of behavior on my part. When things were horrible in San Diego, I found solace in the arms of a woman, but also not only any woman, a woman that was beloved by Chargers fans, who would make me look better, who gave me that Instagram picture of a life when everything behind the scenes is falling apart. And this was the case here. I'd found this young woman who was a former volleyball player who I enjoyed spending time with immensely, but I was a fucking mess behind the scenes. And what she brought to the table once again was some sort of relief in the eyes of everybody else that things were fine. I even went as far as asking her father for her hand in marriage simply because of the optics of it. How fucked up is that? That's who I am. I never took into consideration her feelings or anything. She's watching this whole thing blows up in her face. My family's there. They're ushering me off to some treatment facility. She's stuck in the house we're living in with all the news crews and now investigators probably going to come and ask what all transpired. I'm still selfish because I just go away and I think I'm going to go get the help I need and, you know, everybody else can follow suit, and that's just the selfish nature of my being. And I remember flying home, and we stopped in my hometown, and I'm hiding in my parents' house waiting to go to treatment, and my dad and I get on a plane and we head to Canada. We land in Vancouver. We take a ferry across to this island called Bowen Island, where there's a facility called The Orchard. And it's an old B&B place, beautiful, therapeutic. And it's the first time that I will have been around my people, addicts and alcoholics. I am one of them. They're my people. It's my tribe. I just thought people who went to AA or who were addicts or alcoholics were the worst possible versions of humans you can be, right? That's where the bad people go. I should say this too. When my dad dropped me off, he doesn't show a lot of emotion, but my mom told me the story years later, how difficult it was for him to take your eldest son, who has accomplished so much, and drop him off at a rehab facility. I mean, I'm a father now, so I have an idea of what that emotional toll would have felt like, but again, it didn't register with me. So I was in these rooms and I started listening to the stories from these other people, and I immediately felt like I was a part of it. Like, that's my story. There's some unique differences, but that's my story. That's how I felt. That's how I coped. Those were the results. I knew exactly what that was like. And so I jumped right in. The thing about rehab is it's not real. It's not real life. It's a training program. You're not going to have to deal with real life situations. And I'm extremely good in practice. I'm really good at that. And I become a fan favorite because my work ethic is good, right? I mean, I jump in and I get after it. It's the first time I've been in real counseling where I've actually been open, but it's because I could relate now. There was a why. Why was I such a fuck up for so long? Why was I feeling that way? I was being diagnosed and was finding out that I had clinical depression. I suffered from PTSD. I had a ton of social anxiety, and I was a freaking narcissist. When for the longest time, we don't know why, to be told a why was a game changer. So I knew why I was doing some things, why I went about things differently. And still, you know, you just don't show up and an epiphany happens and 35 years of behavior changes, right? You have to practice and practice and practice because you've ingrained in yourself on how you deal with anything. So the PTSD diagnosis was so out of the blue. I'm like, I haven't been through any trauma. I haven't been through any trauma. I grew up in, you know, a white privileged background, suburban family. Didn't really need for anything, even though we weren't rich. Went to college, was super successful. So I didn't view anything as trauma. And when somebody from somewhere else, from another vantage point, gives you these pictures of your hometown traumatized you, your hometown shamed you your entire youth, you then go to college and are just beloved by a community. And you're like, oh, this is how it's supposed to be. This is how you're supposed to be welcomed into as a family. When I got to San Diego and you're the most beloved thing 1 week and the next week you are the most hated, that can be a traumatic experience. And I remember when they told me it, still, I wasn't like, I'm not a combat veteran, or I'm not somebody who's dealt with a violent encounter. I don't have real trauma, so I didn't give it the weight that it deserved. And they made it very clear that trauma comes in all different sizes and shapes. And it's a matter of how it triggers you and how you then cope with it. And that never was something that I thought I had. And so when they diagnosed me with it, it made sense. But even now, I still struggle with the idea because I do a lot of work with combat veterans now and people who have dealt with violent encounters and things like that. So I almost feel less than when it comes to that, but you cannot define your trauma. It's defined for you. There were moments in treatment where I fucked off and fucked around. I do not recommend people who are going to treatment for the first time or really going to treatment at all to go to a co-ed facility. That is not a good idea because you're distracted. It's the first time you've really felt because you've been on pills for so long. So I felt like a freaking teenager just coming out of puberty. So if there was a pretty girl, like, it was like distracting. And of course, the women are the same way. Our feelings are all over the place and everything like that. And I remember I'm also relishing in the fact that I'm the big football player, right? So everybody knows about it. And we stayed in these rooms. They were beautiful. And I had my room to myself. And this girl comes and knocks on my... I can't remember how it transpired. But of course, I let her in my room. And something goes down. And it's great. And this is rehab. But I immediately knew it was a mistake because of A, if caught, I'm kicked out. And I mean, how apropos would it be? Ryan Leaf goes to treatment and gets fucking kicked out. So the next night comes and she's looking for round two. She's like knocking on my door and I'm like, you can't come in. But then I gotta remember, I don't even think about like the mental fragility of everybody there. So she takes this as a complete dismissal, right? And then she starts spouting off some crazy things, like saying stuff that she's going to hurt herself. And I'm like, what the fuck have I done? I mean, you are an absolute train wreck and you just wreck lives through the process. So I couldn't sleep all night because she went back to her room. And I'm like, and I didn't say anything. I just sat there in the room going, what if we wake up in the morning and those were the images I had. What if she's hung herself or I don't know the mindset of anybody. You never know the mindset of anybody. So I didn't sleep at all that night. I go to breakfast the next morning and there she is sitting, eating her breakfast and everything. I'm just like, fuck, not again. I that was my first week of treatment. Diagnosis that I needed to hear, yet my self-sabotaging nature still in full effect. I fly through rehab with fine colors. There's a family weekend. My family comes for the first time. They feel relieved around the why and understanding more. I was broke. I didn't want my family to have to pay for anything. Rehab's expensive. My union, the NFLPA, has a grant available if you apply for situations like this that I didn't know about. And luckily for me, I was able to apply for this grant and the treatment was going to be paid for because my parents were going to ultimately be on the hook for this. It wasn't even the NFL, it was my union. So it's like, you know, that's what it's there for, right? It's what we paid into in terms of dues for, you'd assume that's the case. So I'm not thinking about anything else. I don't think for a moment while I'm there that there's some criminal investigation going on. I thought I went to deal with my shit. While this is all playing out, there are investigators that are doing a pretty intense investigation into my whereabouts the previous 5 or 6 months, what student athletes I had stolen from, what pharmacies I'd gone to. It would come out in the investigation that I had gotten over 1,000 pills over the last 3 months from pharmacies all over the Texas Panhandle. They would bring in Rachel to interview her. And I read the transcript, I don't know, a while later, but you could tell her anger and how I had fucked everything up, treated her, left her to deal with the broken wreckage. In her final statement to the police as she left, she said, "It's not going to matter. Everything works out for Ryan." And I remember reading that thinking, like, does it? Because it sure as hell doesn't feel that way. And so as I got through rehab, I learned more and more that, like, that relationship didn't have a future, because when somebody goes to treatment, they usually work on themselves and they realize the version of themselves in the past can no longer exist, and that a lot of times involves significant others, and that's a difficult thing for them to understand, especially if they're not getting help correspondingly to when you are getting the help. And when my 28-day stay was over, I knew that that wasn't enough. They have a ton of transitional programs within treatment facilities that people usually don't utilize because they feel so different and they're on what people are calling a pink cloud, where you're just floating with this new education of why you are this way, why you did what you did, how you can treat it in a positive way. And so, luckily for me, the facility had step-down living or sober living of sorts. They had a transitional house on the island, in the woods. I'd have a car. I could go from here or there just to do things I needed to do, start going to meetings. And I got myself a sponsor who would guide me, a mentor of sorts, through this process. And away I went. And again, jumped right into it. It was like a new beginning. Like there was so much ahead of me. And I also was here in Canada, where people don't fucking care about pro football, really. They follow the CFL a little bit, but it's hockey. It's hockey all day, all night, especially in Vancouver, where the Canucks are a living organism. And so I was just this tall guy that people ran into me. They're like, do you play hockey? I'm like, no, I've never been on skates in my life. There wasn't that judgment. There wasn't that. And so I began to live this new life. You know, I had the conversation with Rachel that, you know, I'm not going to be coming back. Like, this is a geographic fix. Then again, it doesn't matter where you go, there you are. That's always been the old adage for me. And so I started to live life again, right? I stayed in transitional housing for 2 months. So with the 28 days plus the next 2 months, that's 3 months sober. I found a nice apartment right downtown Vancouver in a high rise on Granville Street, right in the heart. I started putting out job resumes, looking for some interesting things, and I started going on some dating sites. Now, they recommend you don't date anybody in your first year, but again, I did my own thing, which is why the story gets dramatically worse, because I always try to do it my own way. My self-will is the answer. So I started dating some women. I'm going to meetings. I'm working the steps with my sponsor. My sponsor's a younger guy, kind of the same mentality I have. We become more friends than mentors. We stop doing the steps. I begin to kind of float along on that cloud, doing everything I thought that was right. And this one woman who I had started dating and I were out to dinner. It's been about 6 months since I left to come to treatment in Canada. And I get a text message on my phone, and it's from an old teammate of mine at Washington State. And he's just simply asking, am I okay? And I go, that's a fucking loaded question. Where's that coming from? And I text him back. And I said, yeah, why? And then he shot me the link that read, former NFL quarterback Ryan Leaf indicted on 7 felony charges in Texas. So I find out that way. The media and I have been doing this dance forever, it seems, finding out things. And I sat there and I looked across at this woman I was dating, who I'd been incredibly honest with about why I was there, what I had gone through, but was completely unaware that I was about to be charged in the United States for multitude of felony crimes. But it was the first real time that it was somebody I could have an honest conversation with, like, this is happening. I understand if you need to run from the situation. But, you know, I've always underestimated the ability for other human beings who actually care for you to have your back when shit hits the fan. So it was surprising. Now there was something else I had to deal with, and I would be dealing with this sober for the first time really in my life, with true adversity. So I called the lawyer that we had just talked to before I left Texas in case anything. And I asked him, did you see this coming? And he said he didn't. And I said, okay, what do we have to do? Because it was starting to become a huge news story again, like anything would, right? This stemmed from 6 months ago. Remember when Ryan Leaf would resign from his job around a cloud of drug charges? Well, finally, the next shoe dropped. And here he is, indicted in the state of Texas for burglary, for stealing pills from players, for giving somebody a fraudulent controlled substance. I had gone to a player and given him his pills, but I had removed all the painkillers and put in a placebo or one that looked like it. That's fraud charges when it comes to controlled substances. And I think in the third charge on multiple occasions was doctor shopping, they call it, which was obtaining a controlled substance by fraud. That means going to a doctor one day, saying you're in pain, getting a prescription, going to some other doctor the next day, doing the same thing. You're presenting a fraudulent medical history because you don't divulge that. I was just at a doctor yesterday, got prescribed pills. I didn't know it was actually a crime. I just thought I was doing the wrong thing the right way by going to physicians rather than a drug dealer. And so now it was again a shit show all over the news. Now in Canada, where people are going, are we housing a fugitive? What's that going to look like? Am I going to be forced out of the country? I didn't know, but my attorney told me, hey, you got to come back, turn yourself in, and then we'll deal with this. Plead not guilty, and we'll deal with it and how we have to deal with it. And I was like, I was at least in the best mindset I could possibly be in, being sober 6 months, to probably deal with this thing in a healthy, positive way. And so I said, okay, what do I need to do? He says, well, you need to book a flight. And so I talked to my parents, and of course, they're being inundated with the news and family members and everybody. When something happens like this, too, the immediacy of how people interpret it thinks like something new just happened. Like, what happened 6 months ago is what happened. But what's being reported now 6 months later, everybody assumes this is happening in real time now. Like, oh, he fucked up again. Well, this guy is a mess. And so having to deal with all the fallout from that and then also trying to deal with this in a healthy, positive way. And so my family uses a travel agent. She was able to book me a flight from Seattle to Amarillo in a couple days. And so that was going to be the thing. I was going to drive down from Vancouver through the border to Seattle and fly down to Texas and turn myself in and bond out. And that's how it was going to go. When you are indicted in the United States, there is a warrant issued for your arrest. And it's a fugitive warrant. And so therefore, that's out there in the ether. So if you were to cross the border, there is a fugitive warrant out for your arrest. So my attorney had spoken with the district attorney there in Texas, and apparently had come up with a deal that, hey, Ryan is in Canada, has been in treatment and working a program for the last 6 months. He is going to travel down here to turn himself in. Can you please remove the fugitive warrant so he can travel freely to turn himself in? Well, apparently from what I heard, they had made an agreement that he was going to remove the fugitive warrant and therefore I could travel freely into the United States to fly down and turn myself in. And my naivete, trusting, also never being in a situation with the law before in my life, at all, ever. This would be the first time I was really, you know, going to go into a jail and a mugshot. Just all the things that I had no idea what that included or what it was. And so I packed up my truck, got on the road early one morning, and was going to drive to Seattle to fly out. It's only about a half an hour or so from Vancouver to the border crossing. And I got there really early, you know, probably like 8:30 or 9 in the morning. And I pull up to the window there and I give the Border Patrol my passport, and I can't remember if I was actually nervous about it or I actually believed it full-heartedly that the warrant had been dropped, because what happened next shocked me. I looked at her and she must have touched a button underneath her desk, but she was pretty calm with it, but she kind of backed away a little bit even more with my passport. And as I was looking at her, I noticed out of the corner of my eye in the side mirror of my truck, my vehicle starting to be surrounded by men in SWAT gear and machine guns. And the next thing I knew, I looked up and she had slammed the window shut of the kiosk in which I had handed her my passport. And all of a sudden, through a loudspeaker, as I looked around and was now surrounded by these SWAT men with machine guns, I was being called a fugitive on the run. Please exit your vehicle and lay on the ground face down with your hands behind your back. I couldn't believe this was happening, first off. But instinct kicks in and you just go about the business of doing what you're being told by the men with machine guns. And I exit my vehicle, I walk backwards, and I lay down, and then I'm just rushed by about five or six guys, knees on my neck, on my back. They handcuff me and then take me away. So immediately, like CNN breaks into fugitive Ryan Leaf caught at the border. So there's no context to it again. People are hearing that I'm caught at the border, which has to make them believe I was trying to flee the country.